disturbing. Although in the fine tradition of Edward Said, Geiger Spivak, and many others, I have often disavowed, or at least chafed against, the rubric post-colonial, I have nonetheless been far more institutionally affiliated and formally engaged with the subfield of post-colonial studies than with that of eco-criticism. I wrote my dissertation in the mid to late 90s at the University of Texas at Austin on material and cultural contests over land in South Africa and India, using the fiction of South African novelist Jane Sia and Bengali writer-activist Mahashweta Devi as my primary literary texts. My consideration of these writers' engagements with cultural traditions of imagining relations to spaces like farms and forests, and with spectacular histories of racialized geography, was informed by figures like William Beinart or Colin Bundy, Vandana Shiva, Madhav Yadgadil, and Ramchandra Gupta, not literary critics, but rather historians, more or less, of the particular socio-ecological effects of colonialism and post-colonial nation-building in local contexts within South Africa and India. I was doing something like eco-criticism, I suppose, but in isolation from the critical conversation that was then being institutionalized in the U.S. in the publication, for example, of Cheryl Blatfelty's Eco-Criticism Reader, or the formation of the Association of the Study of the Literature and the Environment. Let me be clear. I did not engage with the emergent discourse of eco-criticism out of some principled stand or even any conscious decision, but rather simply because my reading did not take me there. One reader's fortuitous offhanded comment that I might think less in terms of environmental degradation and more in terms of environmental justice led me to voices like that of Vandana Shiva. Even in 2004 or so, when I began writing about oil extraction, petromagic, and Nigerian literature, my primary guides for how to think about the question of oil were the geographer Michael Watts and the anthropologist Fernando Coronil, who can say provocative things about literature precisely because it's not their primary disciplinary concern. All of this is to say that in some ways I have been a kind of eco-critic for nearly as long as I've been a critic. In other ways, however, because I've mostly taken my cues for how to talk about various environmental questions from outside the discipline of literary studies, I'm very much a latecomer to eco-criticism as an institutionalized discourse. And now I find myself trying to figure out what everyone's been talking about while I was out of the room. So yes, the post-colonialist in me was shocked to find that ethnocentrism is going on here in this discourse of eco-criticism. Let's examine what might seem an unfair example, but one which I hope will get us started. In the introduction to his 2001 book, Writing for an Endangered World, which is a slide, if I could get it. Lawrence Buell writes, the top half of the slide is cut off, but I'll just, let's see. Okay, so we have a map to, PC problem here, where my font is too big. So I'm just going to read the quote, and at some point you'll see the quote on the slide. So Buell says, judging by what it has taken to rouse sizable numbers of non-white male, non-highly educated people to a state of environmental concern, fears for survival of family itself are more powerful motivators than self-sacrificial caring for nature as an intrinsic. I want to examine this statement in some detail, but first let me explain that Buell's book, Writing for an Endangered World, from which I've taken this quote, was an attempt to deprovincialize the questions that he had posed with regard to Thoreau and the American experience in his 1995 book, The Environmental Imagination, and to broaden these questions to the world beyond. He would later take this project one step further in his 2005 book, The Future of Environmental Criticism, in which he offers the term cosmopolitanization to describe what he recognizes as a necessary project of working against the ethnocentrism of second wave eco-criticism. So while I sympathize with Buell's emerging recognition of the need to join questions of environmental justice on a global scale to questions of environmental imagination once assumed to be quintessentially American, I also feel compelled to point out just how ethnocentric and statement is precisely at the moment that he is trying to get beyond ethnocentrism to open up his notion of the environmental imagination. A crude and and ungenerous paraphrase about his statement of the intransigent lack of environmental concern of non-white male, non-highly educated people would go something like this. The benighted, poor, dark, and female just don't get that nature is a good thing, despite the best efforts of enlightened people like me. This claim about the Herculean efforts necessary to convince undereducated non-white males that nature is good for them, or good in itself, is simply outrageous and replicating the local and broader epistemic assumptions about the origins of environmental concern that he's ostensibly working against. Modes of thinking that conflate poverty with pollution in various ways. The poor generate pollution because they don't know any better, don't really mind it, or can't afford not to. Environmental racism both figures the poor as pollutants themselves and justifies the siting of toxic environments.